From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Now, a talk with Philip Roth about his new novel, The Plot Against America. It's an unusual book. It's about Roth's own family when he was a child growing up in Newark, New Jersey in the early 1940s. It's unusual because it also involves historical figures who were real in a plot that is Roth's fictional invention. So first, some background. In 1940, Franklin Delano Roosevelt had already served two terms as President of the United States, and he had led the nation through the Great Depression.
Let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
In 1940, when Britain was already under German attack, the U.S. had not entered the war, and many Americans were against getting involved. FDR sought and won an unprecedented third term, and once in office he continued to support Britain until the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, Germany declared war on the U.S., and American neutrality was no longer sustainable. All of that happened in history, but not all of it happened in Philip Roth's novel. In his story, in 1940, the Republican Party nominates not the internationalist Wendell Willkie, but the immensely popular hero pilot Charles Lindbergh. Lindbergh argued against U.S. entry into World War II and said that three groups were trying to get Americans to fight: the Roosevelt administration, the British government, and the Jews.
If any of these groups, the British, the Jewish, or the administration, stops agitating for war, I believe there will be little danger of our involvement.
In Philip Roth's fictional 1940 election, Charles Lindbergh wins, and the rest is history as it might have been. Philip Roth, welcome.
Hello.
And what inspired you to write a book that is, I must say, unlike anything that I've read of yours?
What inspired me was something that was quite accidental. I was reading Arthur Schlesinger's autobiography, Galleys of It, back in December of 2000. And in 1940, in writing about 1940, he mentions in passing, in one sentence, that the right wing of the Republican Party, or some few Republicans, wanted to nominate Lindbergh for the presidency. There was just that one line, and as you know and as you said, of course, Lindbergh was not nominated. But when I read that line, I wrote a note in the margin of the galley proof I was reading, and the note just said, what if they had? What if he had won? What then would have happened?
One of the interesting tensions in this story is the allure to a young Jewish kid growing up in Newark, New Jersey, whether that was your brother or yourself as a young boy, of Charles Lindbergh, who you were being told was unfriendly to the Jews, but on the other hand, epitomized much else, if not everything else, that was admirable and wonderful about America.
Well, I think prior to Lindbergh's return to America, I think it was in 1938, he returned from living abroad with his wife and his children. They had fled America, as it were, because of the kidnapping and murder of their infant child back in 1933. Until 1938, when Lindbergh returned, Lindbergh was a hero. When he returned to America after having made several trips to Germany, he began to speak out against Roosevelt, against the Democrats, and in favor of isolationism, and soon became the voice of America First, which was the organization that was strongly isolationist. So all of us were taught to think of him as a hero, little kids that we were, and so did the adults think of him as a hero. Only when he entered politics did that diminish. Mm.
What's striking about this book is that it's not just a plot-driven exercise in a speculative historical rewrite. This is about you as a kid. It's about your mother, your father, your brother. It's a very autobiographical novel. It's just the history behind it never happened.
That's right. It's a kind of false memoir, isn't it? In changing the historical facts, I was doing something that was very large. And I'd have my hands full, I realized, just with that. So it seemed to me that what I should then do is change nothing else. And let's see what the impact of this change is on people I know. So I was running a kind of experiment as well.
This is the story of an American Jewish family in the years after Charles Lindbergh was elected President of the United States. I wonder, since American Jews have certainly known social barriers, many if not all of which have fallen away, not state-sanctioned anti-Semitism or pogroms, do you actually see relatively sanguine history as just a lucky break that could have gone otherwise? Or do you think that there's something that's just essentially different about the Jewish experience in America than, say, in Europe?
I think both of the things you suggest are true. There is something essentially different, markedly different, between the experience that Jews had in Europe and that the one they had in America. America was a blessing for them. On the other hand, I do think there is something like a lucky break, too, a historical lucky break. I think they've capitalized on their luck rather remarkably. So I'm not saying that this could have happened. What my book really says is that it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm. I'm searching for the right verb right now. You loved FDR, admired, worshipped FDR. What's the right verb?
As a kid,
mm-hmm.
I was born in the year he was sworn in, 1933, and until I was 12 years old, he was the only president. When he died in 1945 and Truman became president, I didn't actually realize that somebody else could be president.
So when did you realize in the process of writing this novel that you had assigned yourself the job of being an FDR speechwriter? You would get to write
I was also a Walter Winchell speechwriter. Who else's speeches did I write there? Mayor LaGuardia?
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I could do a sustained version, but for a page, I think I could pull it off.
Yeah, there are many other historical figures in the plot against America in your novel, and one very important player was the gossip columnist and broadcaster, whom we're going to hear a bit of right now, Walter Winchell.
And now to the editorial room of the Jurgens Journal, and Walter Winchell.
Good evening, Mr. North American. All the ships at sea. Let's go to press.
New York City. Gene Tierney, the star, and Ali Khan have decided to stay single. She returns to the United States December the 14th. Reno, Mrs. Paul Gallico.
This is your hero?
I have to say, first of all, I didn't write as well as he did. My Walter Winchell is not as good as the real thing.
Maybe you lacked a telegraph key. Maybe that was the problem.
Yes. That's a telegraph key, which was saying nothing, by the way. No Morse code hidden there. Mm. My hero, he's the antagonist to Lindbergh. Walter Winchell was enormously famous in the 30s and 40s. He wrote a gossip column for the Hearst newspapers, but he was known best, I think, for this radio program with that rat-a-tat-tat. And he was largely a gossip columnist and a gossip reporter on the radio until 38, I would say, or 39. And he began to talk about Hitler quite a bit. More than any other, by the way. So here was this cheap gossip columnist who actually was plugged in a way most others weren't or had the audacity to be plugged in. And then, of course, when the war came, he broadcast war news on Sunday nights. I remember that very vividly. I was a kid of 8 when the war began. And I remember that on our street, on a warm night, if you walked down the street, you would hear Walter Winchell coming out of every radio in every house. He's the antagonist to Lindbergh. Mm-hmm. He's the one who announces himself as a candidate for election in 1944 as a Democratic candidate, and he's assassinated.
This is in the novel, we should explain once again.
Yes, indeed, in the novel. In fact, Walter Winchell lived till after the war and dropped into obscurity, really. Why did I choose this guy? I don't know. I was writing the book, and it occurred to me quite spontaneously that Winchell should run for president. It just was so bizarre that it was very appealing. And he is assassinated, and it's his assassination that actually leads to the near-tragic denouement of the novel, and that is mob violence breaks out across America, and there are pogroms for the first time ever in America.
I want to go back to the original premise of what you did here, which was taking your own family and your parents and running them through a series of challenges that indeed you never saw them confront because they didn't happen. Did you find yourself gaining insights into your mother and your father as you posed them, now as fictional characters, against these new challenges like anti-Jewish violence in Newark, New Jersey?
Yes, I did, as a matter of fact.
What did you find out
about it? It was a rather thrilling experience. Mm-hmm. Well, when a situation presented itself in the book, especially a crisis, I had to think, what would he have done? What would she have done? And I tried to be as accurate in imagining it as I possibly could, with the result that I discovered my father's stubbornness, which was notorious, had another side to it in a situation like this. It was resistance. It was defiance.
One other character in your book, Newark, New Jersey. Not a stranger, Newark. Is there more material yet to write about Newark, or have you plumbed the depths of Jewish Newark in the 1930s, 40s, and later?
I don't know. You know, I only really discovered Newark as a subject after the riots at the end of the 1960s that virtually destroyed the city. Now, in the book I just finished, the book I just published, the book we're talking about, that is not Newark and its tragedy. There was my attempt to reconstruct a period and a time in a way not untypical of many writers who want to give you the sense of a place and an era. In the course of writing this book, I went back to the house that I was a little child in, and that's the house that I talk about in the book on a street called Summit Avenue. I hadn't been there in that house since we moved out when I was 9 years old. And fortunately, the landlady was very kind, and I told her the story that I had been brought up there. And she let me go upstairs and go through the apartment that had been ours. And that was quite thrilling. I suppose it's a thrill many people know to return to your childhood home if you haven't seen it for 60 years. And I remember it more or less as it was. I had a few rooms on the wrong side of the house. But I walked through the rooms, and I was, I have to tell you, I was quietly ecstatic.
Ecstatic?
Yes, yes, quietly, but ecstatic.
And remembering things that had happened in
the It was overwhelming. Mm-hmm. It was overwhelming. Not so much remembering as seeing a door to a closet, you know, seeing the floor and the flooring, which was exactly the same, seeing the pantry just off the kitchen, which I really had forgotten about. Seeing how small, actually, the kitchen was in which we lived, seemed to me to have lived our lives. Seeing how small the bathroom was that all four of us shared. But seeing the light coming in through the windows and all of that was very powerful. Yeah.
Well, Philip Roth, thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
Philip Roth, whose new novel is called The Plot Against America.